From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Welcome to The Media Project. It's an opportunity for a half hour of commentary, analysis, and if we are on the top of our game, even some insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union here from the studios of WAMC in Albany with Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Good morning, Rex. Nice to see you. Kaylin, nice to see you.
And all those other publications you used to run. And Dr. Kaylin Brown, the professor of journalism from College of St. Rose, head of the communications department there. Is it communications with an S or without?
With.
With. Thank this you. Is a very important thing in academia, I know.
It actually is. Thank you for asking.
I don't quite understand, but communication is different from communications.
It is, and we deal in the various mediums.
Okay.
Now, should it be email or emails? No, I serious question.
Really?
When you leave your house and you go down to your mailbox, you say, I'm going to go out and get the mail. Do you say, I'm going to get the mails? But why is it that we say we're going to read our emails?
I
say email.
I say email too.
I'm feeling like deer's in a headlight here. You know? Anyway, so Dr. Shartok is not with us today, but he will be back after his little vacation. We'll have an opportunity to get back into all the issues that matter to him as well. You know, we should start off. The hurricanes are now in our rearview mirror, we hope, for a while. But there was much hoopla about the kind of reporting that went on television in particular. It was kind of outrageous, isn't that fair to say?
The way the reporters were putting themselves in harm's way. And the criticism that's resulted from that, is that what you're referencing, Rex?
That's a very interesting perspective.
Right. And a lot of stories have been written about the fact that reporters put themselves in harm's way, but we know from conflict reporting that indeed they do that a lot. So it's not unusual that the reporters went to see how the storm was playing out in neighborhoods and people's lives so that they could show people that they should beware and be careful because their lives could be jeopardized.
But when someone is embedded with the military and they're covering a war and they're with the troops, I don't know that they actually go out into the middle of the battlefield and say, in effect, here, try to get me. When you're covering these storms, when these reporters in the field, and they deserve a lot of credit for doing what it is they're doing, but they're standing in this storm. We watch this. I sort of think we watch this the way some people watch race car driving, the waiting to see if there's going to be an accident. You watch a guy on TV or a woman on TV in the middle of 145-mile-per-hour gust, and I'm wondering whether there's going to be a projectile, a tree branch, a piece of glass is going to fly by and cut them in half. Is there any reason for those people to be there? Why can't the anchors be in a safe place and the pictures, without the body in the front of the pictures, describe what it is that's going on.
Isn't there something, too, to the showbiz aspect of it? Now, we have to recognize that there's nothing wrong with trying to attract an audience. We do that by putting good photographs on the front page of a newspaper, mm-hmm. You know, by writing headlines that we think capture imagination. But there is something when Chris Cuomo on CNN takes off his shirt so that what we see on TV are bulging biceps beneath his T-shirt and overalls, which my wife pointed out to me. And she said, wow, this is a fantasy for a lot of women. That's like a firefighter standing there in the rain. Is that really part of the reporter's portfolio, or is that just showbiz?
Objectifying any reporter is never right. The fact that these reporters had put themselves in harm's way was their decision, and the criticisms I read and their responses, they said our employers would not have let us go out there if they thought our lives were in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's true, and I know when I was a young reporter at Newsday when Hurricane Gloria hit Long Island, and we had reporters who went out into the teeth of the storm. Even though they were print reporters, there was no glory to them for being out there in the midst of this. One reporter took cover in a phone booth. You remember there were such things, glass phone booth, which turned out to not be a good idea because the wind shattered the glass.
But you're saying that the print reporters did, in effect, what these anchors did.
Exactly.
See, that surprises me and that aggravates me. I just, you know, I think that reporters need to be on the scene and they need to be in a safe place at the height of the storm so that they can be staged before the storm to warn people and then after the storm to describe what's going on. But I just think the actual appearance of these people in the middle of the storm, and people are mesmerized by it. There's no question it's a ratings driver. The Weather Channel, I believe, their ratings go up on these storms by a significant amount. But I would argue that you don't need those people there for those ratings to be as high as they are.
It's worth pointing out that, as Kaylin points out, the tradition of reporters actually going out and being in harm's way is an important element of it. Dan Rather came into the public consciousness working for KHOU in Houston in 1961 when he actually was the first reporter ever to do a live radar image of a hurricane on screen. And then he actually went out into the streets to show conditions firsthand. And that gave him his first exposure to a national audience. But that characterized his reporting throughout, even after he was a famous anchor. He concealed himself in something almost like a burqa. He concealed himself in robes to go behind and report on the Mujahideen. And this kind of reporting was the way that he went about his work. There's always a question, I think, when you're looking at, especially at television, between the element of what is showbiz and what is really aggressive reporting, trying to get people really into the story and see it firsthand.
Well, I agree with you that the showbiz element is something that we in print don't have to deal with, except we in print have to sell newspapers. So there is, in fact, some similarities. And the question is, how are you going to do it? I mean, I wonder whether or not the print newspapers that now have the ability to go live on the internet, I'm wondering whether they sent their reporters out to do what some of these anchors did. My guess is they didn't, although it's possible, you know, that the Miami Herald's website had a video stream with reporters out there in the middle of it.
As long as the incentive is not exploitation for their careers and the true purpose is to get information for the viewer, listener, reader, I think that it's, again, it's justified. We think of other reporters, again, who put themselves in harm's way. I think of Danny Pearl, who wrote for the Wall Street Journal and wanted to cover some serious issues concerning 911 at the time and the Middle East. And he ended up not coming home, and he was beheaded on camera. But he knew that he was putting himself in harm's way, and still he thought it was worth pursuing that story. And I remember meeting Danny Pearl because he was a reporter for the Berkshire Eagle, and he came for an interview at the Times Union Business Desk. And I will never forget him bringing in a sheet with his resume of all the leads he had written for the Berkshire Eagle. And he was so proud of each lead that he had a whole page filled with these leads. And within a couple of weeks, his byline showed up in the journal.
Isn't this something?
Yeah.
I had no idea. This was before I came to the Times Union,
I
think.
Yeah,
right?
I was on the business desk then.
Really?
He came and had interviewed with the business desk. And the day that I looked at the Wall Street Journal,
with all due respect, what fool didn't hire him, you know?
Well, I think vice versa. I think that he must have been looking at multiple
on
places.
On the edge of, Wall Street Journal, Times Union, well, it's a big choice.
He said, I guess you're not joining us.
Yeah, what do you know? There is, by the way, an interesting article in Columbia Journalism Review for listeners who want to go online and check it out, cjr.org, talking about how reporters in Florida did their job during Irma. Same kinds of stories were written just 2 weeks ago about the significant efforts at my sister papers, the Houston Chronicle, the Beaumont Enterprise, and the TV stations down there in Texas that went through the same sort of thing.
Well, you know, when Trump a couple of weeks ago made this one of his many ridiculous comments about how after the Harvey that the journalists didn't go into the storm. Well, of course they did. Number one, but lengths to which these reporters have to give up their not only their safety, but their everyday lives, you know, while the storm is potentially swallowing up their homes in South Florida, their staffs in the Miami Herald building working 12 to 14 hour shifts to get this news out there. And you know that they're as nervous and worried about their families and their own property as is everybody else. Yet their dedication is to cover the story.
That's the fake media that's doing
the
fake news. Yeah, yeah, that's who's doing that. And this is, I think, important for people to remember when we hear all the ongoing onslaught, the attacks on the media, which, by the way, there's been a little bit less of that from the White House in their last couple of weeks.
Starting to get good press. What about the
perhaps the conciliatory mode with making deals, quote unquote, with the Democrats?
How about the fake media saying that the hurricane was coming and Rush Limbaugh, in effect, saying, no, don't listen to that. They're just trying to sell newspapers and generators.
Rush Limbaugh, he who had to then evacuate his broadcast center in Florida in the face of the storm that the fake media had oversold, really?
And you think about it.
I reject him wholeheartedly.
You think about it seriously. If there are people out there who don't believe the media and the media was warning people about this hurricane and they didn't believe them and stayed put, I wonder whether they're still alive today.
It's important that people resist the urge to be lazy when they're consuming information and that they go the extra step and don't depend on a tweet and that they look at what's behind the information that they're reading. It requires effort and sustained focus. I think that that is often missing, and that is why we might be in the situation we're in now. I realize people's time is spread thin and we have many responsibilities in this society. But one of our responsibilities as citizens is to inform ourselves and to get full stories, not just tweets.
Absolutely true. That's Kaylin Brown from the College of St. Rose, Ira Fussfeld of the Daily Freeman in Kingston. I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. We are happy to be here as part of the Media Project. You can share your thoughts, media@wamc.org. And we would love to hear your views, and we can translate them into some of the conversations on the air. As you're talking about people trying to be well-informed, Kaylin, about the news that's in front of them, one of the difficulties, of course, is knowing what's real and what is not, deciphering the line between real reporting and what is genuinely fake news, as opposed to the way the term is now often bandied about by the president and his supporters. And one of the difficulties that we are finding, one of the things that is being uncovered apparently by the FBI and by Robert Mueller's investigation, is the depth of Russia's involvement, the state-owned media outlets intruding into the realm of what has been real reported news. Yes?
Well, I'm curious to hear what you both think about the Facebook element in this, that it's now being revealed that Facebook sold or authorized domain names to people who, as it turns out, were Russian infiltrators who were trying to impact the election. And Facebook's getting a lot of bad press on this. I'm wondering whether it's deserved.
I would say it is deserved, but I don't believe that it's bad. I think it's just accurate press, and the press is reflecting what happened with Facebook, which should be considered suspect in terms of news delivery, because Facebook's job and its mission is to make money. It is not to deliver information to help an informed citizenry make decisions about how to be governed. So Facebook, which I have issues with, is not subject to the same sort of codes as is professional journalism. In fact, none.
But Facebook has abandoned that role. Facebook has always, and the other social media platforms as well, have always insisted, well, we're just passing along stuff. We're not a communication medium. We're not journalism. While in effect, they have been actually fulfilling all the roles of a publisher. And I think it's likely, from what I'm seeing, at least in media coverage of those who are covering Congress, it's likely that Facebook is going to be called into congressional hearings on what it did and what it didn't do in accepting advertising dollars from Russian state-owned media to that in turn posted fake stories that exacerbated the divisions in America. About it in her new book, which I see is sitting next to you, Kaylin, here, What Happened? She writes about the Russian manipulation of the election, which she refers to as an attack on our democracy by our principal foreign adversary, which she says much more serious than Watergate. And the fact is, these publishers, notably Facebook, the most powerful publisher, let's call it that, in the world today, has been really susceptible to fake and damaging information sent through social media. And there needs to be some serious soul searching by Facebook. But the responsibility, I think the point you were making, Kaylin, earlier, is the responsibility is really on us as consumers to look for multiple sources, right?
Back to the Bible of journalism, the elements of journalism by Kovac and Rosenstiel. One of the primary points when they talk about what are the components of journalism, citizens have rights and responsibilities too. In our classrooms, we talk about the fact that if a citizen recognizes there's a problem with coverage, they have a responsibility to contact the source of that information and notify that source that there is a problem with the coverage. To sit at home and complain that there's something wrong with the news and not to speak up and contact the news is a sin by omission. So citizens should be absolutely monitoring their media and noticing what's accurate and inaccurate.
The problem is, though, that I get a lot of mail from people attacking our accurate reporting. And maybe I just have to absorb this and say, well, that's the role that I play. I'm the, like, the adjustments window at Macy's. People just come to me with all their complaints. But the fact is, when we do stories accurately pointing to issues in the news that conflict with people's opinions, they attack us. For example, whenever we write about the impact of human-caused global warming, I get emails and letters from people attacking me for being a shill for the climate lobby and for the left wing. And I know that our reporting is based upon science. And so if people are, yes, playing that little bit of a role of watchdog, but they are being misled by those who have less concern about facts.
And ultimately, journalism has to continue to do its job and to report the facts and not to give up and to work harder.
Let's just for a second go back to Facebook, because I don't understand fully how they work. I don't know how much of it is automated and how much of it is a human being looks at the material before it's posted. I'm going to presume that most of it is automated. And so if somebody came into my newspaper office when I was the publisher and there was an advertisement that one of the salespeople thought should be reviewed by me as the publisher, I would do so and I could make a decision whether or not it was fit to run in our newspaper or not. I don't know whether that there is a similar process at a Facebook, at a Twitter. And so if there's not, should there be? I would suppose there should, but I don't know how difficult that is when you're talking about millions of posts a day. I guess that's the right number.
There is a process, and Facebook has made a big deal out of, I think they hired 1,000 more people to review content, but Facebook is so huge, so many billions of posts a day that they're
exactly.
getting only, I probably misstated that, probably not billions of posts a day. I should get the number before I use
many,
it.
Many posts a day.
A lot. That they can't keep up with it. But you think about this, think about the vast profits of Facebook and why it is valued so highly. And consider that maybe some of those profits ought to be turned into responsible editing or curation, the word would be today, of the content to make sure that it is accurate rather than just passing along. That does conflict, though, with the ethic of Facebook, which is it's a free platform. People can say what they want. You control it. You decide what you want to see. I can understand there's a conflict there, but I would not be surprised. But what we'll find ourselves in a position in a very short time, in a very few years, where there are going to be calls to break up Facebook in the same way that there were calls to break up Ma Bell, you remember, and which happened in the 1980s.
Yeah, but Ma Bell had literally no competition. I mean, the internet is wide open. There's dozens and millions of various sites. I mean, Facebook's obviously the 500-pound gorilla. But I mean, if I'm a guy sitting in my basement in Moscow who wants to try to troll and interfere with our election by putting up a phony name and then posting an opinion that turns out to be baloney, I'm not sure how easy. Maybe it is easy and they have to work harder to stop it. But I don't know how Facebook can prevent that from happening.
Yeah, or how we as citizens can really deal with what has become an aggressive effort by a very powerful government, in the case of Russia, making intrusions into our information sphere with fake news. Look at the remarkable piece of reporting by Jim Rutenberg in the Sunday New York Times magazine. Jim Rutenberg is now the media columnist for the Times. The headline is RT Sputnik and Russia's New Theory of War, which is really taking a look at the way that Russia's media and social media machinery contributed to the information chaos that preceded our last election and how that's we're likely to see more of that going forward. The burden then really coming down to citizens to figure out, wow, how do I know what's real and what's not?
It was early in the presidential campaign. I would say perhaps as early as, I want to say 2014, that the Clinton campaign identified that the Russian government was leading an information war on the U.S. media and had manipulated information and had undermined the base of what was true and what was not true and was trafficking in false information. But at first, according to Clinton's book, What Happened, that was not taken seriously by our media. And the question has been raised whether or not, I know there was a Washington Post article that talked about Clinton perhaps wrongly accusing the media of being partially responsible for the result of the election. But I agree that the media is partially responsible.
Don't you think that that charge is largely because of the amount of free time that Trump was given, the wall-to-wall coverage of virtually all of his rallies, whereas the other Republican candidates were not similarly afforded that kind of coverage.
$5 billion worth is the estimate by the media tracking firm MediaQuant. Yeah. $5 billion of free advertising that the Trump campaign got that his Republican opponents did not get. That is in the form of coverage, live coverage of his rallies, that kind of thing.
Right. And the news coverage actually is considered by the consuming public as more viable. So when the news covers a story rather than a paid ad being placed, the readership, viewership, and listenership gives more weight to that information and actually takes that more seriously than a paid ad. Mm-hmm. So that's compounded the value of the coverage.
And I think Secretary Clinton has a strong argument when she points to the fact that the media, in covering the campaign in this great effort to have, quote, balanced coverage, gave outrageous amounts of attention to her email issues that were not on a scale as consequential as, frankly, the lies and misstatements that were coming out of her opponent's campaign.
Well, and then you had Fox News, which many are considering it a state-run kind of operation now, but Fox News, you couldn't turn it on during the day without hearing the word Benghazi throughout the entire... When they weren't talking about email, they were talking about Benghazi.
And the emails were clearly released almost simultaneously or shortly after the Hollywood Reporter recording of the president mm-hmm. talking about his assault on women came out. So the timing of the WikiLeaks email releases were in close proximity to when that Hollywood Reporter video/audio was released.
Now, that all said, I think I know the answer to this, but where do you stand on the whole concept of the Clinton book? That, yes, she has a right to write the book. Yes, she has a right to make some money. But do you believe that all of the issues she's raising now are problematic for the Democratic Party, which is trying to get past this election and move forward?
So I haven't read the whole thing. I bought it 2 days ago on the day it came out. I had it reserved at our local bookhouse, the Bookhouse in Stuyvesant Plaza, which I'm plugging primarily because they're independent and they deserve to be plugged.
Here, here.
And they were wonderful in getting the book to me so quickly. But what I noticed in this book is that there should be no diminishment of the Democratic Party's stand based on what she's written. She is still a viable and vibrant member of the Democratic Party. And the book, from what I've read so far, is filled with integrity. And this is an individual who is continuing to contribute to the public conversation from a very, not from a weakened position, from a position that was unexpected from her perspective.
Yeah. One of the interesting points that she mentions that is worth thinking about on a media show is this, that the media analyst Andrew Tindall has done some analysis, some research into this. He says that Clinton's emails earned three times as much nightly news coverage from the networks as policy issues from the beginning of 2016 to mid-October in the campaign. So the emails became the issue that led to the demise of her credibility and ultimately perhaps to her defeat.
And when you look at this book, all you see is a credible individual with substantive thinking who is fact-based, experience-based, and no tweet could ever match what this book and her earlier books have provided over the course of a lifetime of public service.
Well, I thought it was humorous when they asked Sarah Huckabee whether or not Trump was going to read the book, and she said, no, I don't think he will. And my first thought was, when was the last time he read any book?
Well, I mean, that's actually a valid question. That's not a slam.
Read.
He has said that he doesn't have time to read.
Yeah.
So maybe he's watching the interviews on television. Who knows?
Oh, he is without a question watching them. And in fact, he's already tweeting about them.
Really?
Yeah.
I wonder if he could even get through the prologue. Each of the chapters has a prologue. This quote that Clinton uses from the film A League of Their Own. It's supposed to be hard. If it wasn't hard, everyone would do it. The hard is what makes it great. So this is her. Keep going. We're not seeing that White House.
There's no crying in politics.
There is, sadly. Anyway, no crying in journalism. We're done here. Ira Fussfeld, Caitlin Brown, and Rex Smith, we are the Media Project this week, and we thank you all for joining us. See you next week.
They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. when they know they've got a people's fight to wage.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Kaylin Brown is the chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose. And Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
You represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers.